and welcome to Sew Stories of Life. I'm your host, Tia King, and this episode is sponsored by Civil Life Brewery, makers of extraordinarily tasty, handcrafted beer. This episode's theme is the park. I am delighted to introduce our speakers, Christopher Harrison, with his tale of U.S. military intelligence. Nick Drago, reading from his memoir, Use Once, Then Destroy. Brilliant performance artist Erin Renee Roberts. I love her. And of course, our recurring musical guest, Matt McGahey. Our first guest is a dear friend and one of the biggest supporters of Sew Stories of Life. This is Christopher Harrison.
I served in the Army from 1985 to 1992 as a signals intelligence analyst. At first thought, that seems like a job that wouldn't have a lot of time spent out of doors, in the field, as we called it. And you'd be mostly right, except in certain times and certain places. One of those places is the Republic of Korea, and the time was the spring of 1992. One of the most obvious things about an army, any army, is the uniform. Some days it's camouflage work uniform, some days it's the bright dress uniform with the ribbons and the medals. When you're in the field, pieces get added that you never wear any other time. A helmet, gas mask, the web belt and shoulder straps. We used to call it LBE, load-bearing equipment. I don't know what they call it now. It's all different. Every day, unit commanders specify the uniform of the day. This is what everyone will be wearing today so that everyone looks the same. Some days, you know, any of the combinations that I said. So especially when you're in the field, though, commanders might get a bit lazy because they've got to post this somewhere, and there's no place to post things when you're in the field. So things get left off. The obvious things get left off. And this particular time, we were out in this field training exercise, and the uniform of the day was stated as Kevlar helmet, LBE, pro mask. No mention of pants, shirt, boots. That was all left assumed. And that'll be back to us later. Now, Korea in the 80s and 90s, we had a bit of a problem when we were in the field with these elderly gentlemen, mostly gentlemen, who would show up outside our perimeter during the day selling junk food or beer, or on really good days, toilet paper. And they would do this so they could get an idea of who we were and how we were laid out, and then they would come back in the middle of the night and steal anything that wasn't nailed down, just totally anything they could carry away. So because of this, and because I was in an intelligence unit, and our equipment was sensitive and, more to the point, expensive, we always put up lights and wire around our perimeter. But we only turned the lights on if there was a problem because, you know, people are sleeping. And, you know, there were upsides to this, concessions to the peace. Our field training was conducted at prepared sites. They were flat, good drainage. We put up big tents and, you know, sleep 20 people to a big tent instead of the little pup tent thing sleeping on the ground. Sometimes there were hand-pumped wells where we had actual running water, visits from the mess hall with at least one hot meal a day, and, of course, porta-johns so that we didn't have to dig a latrine. And we'd attach our perimeter wire to either side of the little fiberglass buildings so that we didn't have to go out the gate to use them, but the guy who came every day to clean them didn't have to come inside to do that. And intelligence collection work happens all the time, so when we would have to go to the field because some general somewhere said so, we just went and did our regular everyday mission the same as we would do any other day, the same as we would do if we were at war. So we rarely felt the need to actually set up perimeter guards except perhaps as a punishment detail, because we were always up, we were always working. There was no time that, you know, everyone was asleep, so we didn't really need a guard as such. Now we get to the good part. Imagine, if you will, a 25-year-old sergeant waking up in the middle of the night with a powerful urge to pee, laying for a while in his sleeping bag, debating the relative merits of trying to go back to sleep versus having to put pants on, and finally remembering that the specified uniform of the day doesn't say anything about pants. So I stood up, I stuck my feet in my boots, I grabbed my helmet, my LB with the gas mask attached to it, and off I trudged out of my tent 10 yards or so to the tiny fiberglass building. I let myself in, I latched the door, I turned around, I sat down, only to discover that this unit was previously occupied. Not by another person, of course, but by some small, angry, furry animal whose tail I just stepped on. A small, angry, furry animal who was bent on revenge for his, or possibly her, now aggrieved tail. Take a moment, if you will, to consider the relative positions. Small animal, excellent night vision, on the floor of a confined space, but with more than adequate room to maneuver. Large human, essentially blind in the dark, underwear around his knees, unbuckled equipment belt dangling around, unfastened helmet trying to fly off, no room to move, and essentially always in contact with one of the walls, because that's how big I am. The small, angry animal is equipped with a full set of teeth and claws, and the human has no flashlight, no nothing. A knife, which I have here somewhere. This knife, which was attached to the strap that was unfastened, and so I had to fight to get a hold of it and finally get it out. It's very mean looking. Finally get the knife out, and the rat, because of course it's a rat, what else would be in a port-a-john, in a field, in Korea, was inside my boot, because I didn't tie my boots, I just stuck my feet in there. Crap! I can't stab into my own boot. My foot is in there, I need that. So I'm kicking and I'm shaking my leg to try to get it out, and though I didn't notice it at the time, I was apparently screaming like a little girl. So the rat falls out of my boot and it's on. It's a fight. I still can't really stab at the rat because I can't see it and I don't want to stab myself. But every time it comes in contact with me, I can slash at it, kind of like a lunatic. And it's getting teeth into me, and it's getting claws into me, and it's trying to climb up my leg, and I'm trying to get rid of it. Finally, somehow, the rat falls into the crotch of my shorts, which are around my knees, somewhat twisted. At this point, I became extremely nervous. I shot up, I spun around, I hit the wall, and the whole little fiberglass building just came apart. And it dumped me and my little enemy onto the ground. We rolled, we got tangled. I could see him clearly in the lights. I stabbed into death. I started to cut away the bloody fabric. Wait. Lights. It's the middle of the night. There's not supposed to be light. Shit. My screams had roused everyone. And of course, someone had thrown the master switch for the lights, and now 120 of my nearest friends are staring at me, naked, scratched up, covered in blood and mud, tangled in my LB. My helmet is gone. I can deal with this. I'm a professional. Wipe my knife on something. I don't even know. Slap it back into the sheath. Stand up. Sort of dust myself off. The nearest private, whose name I immediately come to mind, I yell at him to find me my damn helmet and bring it to me in my tent. And I do the thing. I march back to my tent. And I'm sitting there on my cot, and I've got my little first aid kit, and I'm cleaning up hundreds of scratches. And in comes the medic with my helmet and her big first aid kit. Her big first aid kit. And a long lecture on something called Korean hemorrhagic fever, which you get from contact with rats and rat droppings, and which causes you to bleed out of your orifices and die. Oh, so she cleans me up, antiseptic stuff and bandages and whatnot, and I go back to sleep, and everybody goes back to sleep. Sunrise, I get up, I go to the mess hall, who've come out from the unit rear, and lo, in addition to these containers of powdered eggs and already cold bacon, is a rat on a stick, nicely cooked. Yeah. And the medic waiting in her truck with the engine running for me to get there, drive me to Seoul to the 121 evac hospital, which those of you who watched MASH, you've heard of that. It's a real unit. It's still there. I spent a week in the hospital, IV fluids and whatever the right medicine is for Korean hemorrhagic fever so that I didn't die, and got released from the hospital just in time to go back to where we were all camped out and break everything down and take it back to the rear and clean everything. Since I had had a good rest, I got to clean everything. And that's the rat story. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Matt McGahee is our resident musician. Not only does he have the task of coming up with a story to fit each month's theme, but he also has the challenge of writing a new song or two to fit as well. That's what I call double duty, and he does it well. People, this is Matt McGahee.
Well, thanks for being here tonight. I'm looking forward to hearing the stories, and I just wanted to start off with a song. The theme of the night is the park. And parks have taken on a whole new meaning for me now that I'm a father. And as I mentioned, I'm the father of a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old, two little boys. And it used to be, years ago, before I had kids, the park was a place to go at night, you know, and smoke weed, smoke cigarettes before going home because we had nowhere else to go. Now the park is a destination or a bribe or a reward for my two boys. We'll bump into kids from school and parents that we've seen for years but have never met. We release our kids to run and tire themselves out while we try not to play, try not to be helicopter parents, and try not to let other parents see us checking Facebook when we should really be watching our kids. Yeah, sometimes you'll catch adults really playing, though, and sometimes I'll even catch myself trying to see how high I can swing or if I can make it across the monkey bars without falling, and then I'll pay the price for the next couple of days. And sometimes my kids will just beg me to play with them, and I'll proclaim, "This park is full of kids. Go play with them." And they may look at me quizzically and then punch me in the face and then run off. Or just not get why I won't play with them. After all, you know, we're in a park. So the first song I want to share tonight has nothing to do with my story that I just told, really. But it's a song called A Falling Down, and I wrote it when I was living in Chicago. And I don't know if anybody's lived in Chicago before, but walking through the streets of Chicago, you pass tons of parks and It's kind of the whole city is a park. You have an opportunity to engage with all sorts of life. And so this was just a song that I wrote after a walk to the train one day. Just kind of a rumination on that. Streamlined jaw, get your face in the mud, and fathomless we travel, we're all just looking for God. Towards a likeness only being, I thought I heard someone screaming. It sounded like a muffled voice, but I did not make the choice. It was too early to discern between a troubled child and a car alarm. My eyes were just deceived. If I went looking, I still would not believe. But I was walking back to sleep anyways. Should have just stayed put and never laughed at your request. Barely do I not scatter. I held on, but it didn't matter anyway. So the streamlined jaw, it cut its pattern out, left his fingerprint on the fresh cement. It took a falling down and a stomping ground to prove it all could not be found. But I was walking back to sleep anyway. Should it just stay put and never laugh your request. Barely do I not scatter. I held on, but it didn't matter anyway. So we're midway through the thick of it. Yeah, I know you don't really give a shit. But my wind-tossed breath, it took a hold on me. I started to drift back to obscurity as I was walking back to sleep anyways. Should I just stay put and never laughed at your request. Barely do I not scatter. I held on, but it didn't matter anyway. Yeah. Enjoy the rest of the night. Thank you.
Nick Drago's life can best be described as treacherous. He's been a regular guest at So Stories of Life, sharing stories from his memoir, Use Once, Then Destroy. His readings are part gumshoe detective, part vulnerable honesty, and entirely enthralling. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Nick Drago.
Everybody at the restaurant had caught the same vibe from Dominic. He had a very eerie presence about him. Shady, they all would say. Blair hired him as a waiter because he was good-looking and had an English accent. He wasn't rude or anything, but he always had this guilty look on his face. It dominated his entire demeanor. Late one night after work, Dominic and his tomboy girlfriend, Paula, were going home from work and decided they wanted to score a few bags of heroin. They lived just across the street from Tompkins Square Park, which was known as Heroin Central on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Anyone looking to cop some dope need look no further. As soon as they entered the park, they were approached by a nervous acting man who asked them if they were looking to buy some smack. How many y'all need? Three, Dominic said. The dealer searched his pockets of his jeans and shirt while gripping a glass pipe with the other hand. I know I got that shit somewhere. I got one bundle left. A bundle is 10 dime bags of heroin, usually packed together with a rubber band. You can get one for $90 if you buy 10 at one time, you know. The bundle that this crack-addled peddler of poison was searching for had fallen under the ground under the notice of dope-hungry Dominic, who quickly stepped on it to hide it from its frantic owner. Damn! Can y'all wait right here a few minutes? I'll be right back with that shit. We'll be right here, mate, said Dominic, literally not moving. The second this man was out of sight, Dominic picked up the dope, grabbed Paula's arm, and took off. Back at their apartment, they each snorted a bag, but they knew it was a bad idea to have that much shit at their fingertips. They both had survived serious heroin habits and were now trying to be extra careful not to get hooked again. So they decided to keep four bags and sell the rest to their friends. Two of those bags would be the first heroin I would ever ingest. Flamingo East was an Art Deco-styled restaurant lounge on 2nd Avenue in the East Village of Manhattan. I worked there as a waiter and a bartender in the early 90s, a couple years after I moved to New York City. The restaurant attracted a hip downtown crowd and was constantly busy. It was a very demanding place to work. Having a cocktail at the end of the night to wind down became as regular as having a cup of coffee in the morning to wake up. I made friends with most of the staff at Flamingo East, and we partied together quite often. I was in my early 20s at this time and dealing with the recent breakup of a serious relationship. It turned out being single and working at a trendy night spot was good for me during this troubled time. I went to some cool parties, some fun clubs, and met some really fun, interesting people. Drugs were everywhere. Despite all the new trippy drugs on the market, marijuana was still my drug of choice. I smoked it so often that it didn't even seem illegal anymore. Ecstasy was popular along with Special K and the ever-present cocaine, but I wasn't crazy about speedy highs. I used cocaine when I had too much to drink and needed to stay alert. Ecstasy was fun with a date or if you wanted to dance all night at a club. Acid, mescaline, and psychedelic mushrooms were fun to do once in a while with friends, and Quaaludes could just get you taken advantage of. None of these drugs brought me down or kept me from handling my responsibilities. I used them all in moderation, and when I saw that I was using something too much, I stopped. Very abruptly and without any trouble. So when Dominic came to work the next day and told me about his exciting score and asked me if I wanted to buy a bag of heroin, I thought it was something that I could handle. Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to make excuses like I didn't know better. I was somewhat informed of the dangers of drug abuse as much as anybody that grew up during the Reagan administration. Well, which, come to think of it, wasn't much. But I did hear all the tragic stories of heroin abuse, seen all the gritty urban dramas about some promising young kid getting hooked and the inevitable downward spiral that follows. The truth is, I had used drugs recreationally for a few years and still managed to keep a job and pay my bills and support myself. I didn't think anything would change if I sampled a little dope. But still, I was reluctant to accept Dominic's offer. After telling him that I would think about it, he wrote down his number on a book of restaurant matches, and I put them in my pants pocket. At the end of the night, after I counted my tips and had a drink at the bar, Kelly, the hostess, came over to me, told me that my ex-girlfriend Nicole was on the phone. She had been my ex-girlfriend for a long time. It took us a couple years to really break up. We were caught in this cycle of not seeing each other for a couple months, then getting together and spending weekends together alone and avoiding everyone. After about 48 hours, we would remember why we broke up and spend the rest of the time fighting. This scenario always ended up with me at a bar getting drunk and telling myself I would never speak to Nicole again. With this phone call, the destructive cycle that our relationship had become would take another destructive turn. I stepped out of the noisy lounge and onto the rainy sidewalk in search of a cab. It was after midnight on a Friday, but the neighborhood seemed quiet. As I sat in the taxi on my way to Nicole's apartment, I sank into a melancholy state. I knew that going to see Nicole was a bad idea. I knew that nothing could come of it, and the more we saw each other, the worse it would be in the end. I cabbed it over to her Chelsea apartment, and a typical night ensued. We had some wine, took turns lying to each other about what we had been up to since the last time we saw each other, and after the sex, it was all downhill. Our conversation turned to who we were dating, then who was to blame for our breakup. We fell asleep angry after a long, psychotic argument. The next morning, while we were having coffee and not speaking, two of Nicole's friends stopped by. Their giggling, gossipy murmurs disgusted me so bad I retreated back to the bedroom to get it dressed so that I could leave and put a great distance between us. I found Dominic's number in my pocket and I called him. Sitting on the bed with the phone in my hand, I waited for my conscience to talk me out of what I was doing. I reminded myself of the dangers of heroin and thought about all the brilliant people that had succumbed to its unrelenting grip. I really tried to refrain from making that call, but down deep I knew very well that I was way too curious to leave it alone. I didn't know it then, but that moment was the most pivotal point in my life. I seriously waited to come to my senses, but it never happened. After Dominic gave me his address, I was on my way. Walking down 8th Avenue to the subway and ignoring my conscience, I discovered that the day couldn't have been more beautiful. It was late May, the air was soft, and the sun was mild. The Manhattan sidewalks were crowded with people digging the spring weather. Nicole's apartment was on 23rd Street, directly across from the Chelsea Hotel. Every time I passed the Chelsea, I imagined Sid Vicious being dragged out by the cops. This time I stare at the old Chelsea and I wonder if my life is the one that's going to spin out of control and possibly end. What the fuck am I doing? I finally ask myself. For a moment, I considered turning back, but then I tell myself I'm too strong and too wise to let a drug bring me down. Stop, stop, go back, turn around, don't do this, I said. But my legs kept moving. I didn't really believe that I was too strong to let this get me down. It was just that if I would have turned back, nothing would have happened. And at that point in my life, I was just too into discovering new kicks to want to turn back. I approached the building and pressed the buzzer. A few seconds later, an unfamiliar voice said, "Hello," then buzzed me in. The voice belonged to Paula, who answered the door in nothing but two bath towels. Dominic was wearing a pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt, and he looked like he just got out of bed. "Hey, what's up, man?" We talked a few minutes, and the Englishman showed me his stolen goods. Five small wax paper bags folded into inch-long rectangles containing the deadly narcotic. Upon his recommendation, I purchased two. After receiving dosage instructions from the expert, I left and walked across the street into Tompkins Square Park. There was a restroom there that would provide me with the privacy I needed. Also, I wanted to do it in a public place. In case of an overdose, I would have a chance at someone discovering me. At this point, I had no interest in liquefying the powder and injecting it into my arm. China White was a very fine grade of heroin that could be easily snorted, so that is how I first chose to sample it. So, I ducked into a stall in the restroom, retrieved the dime bags from my pocket, unfolded one, and inserted a rolled-up dollar bill inside and inhaled some of the light brown powder. I paused a minute and waited. Nothing. I inhaled the rest of what was in the bag, waited again, then felt a kind of heaviness. My nose began to tickle and my face got warm. I stood up to further assess the sensation, suddenly felt warm all over. I staggered over to and found a lonely tree to sit under, and for a few hours I sat there, nodding in and out of consciousness, I guess, feeling the blood rush under my skin, not moving. I eventually fell asleep. I woke up and I vomited. I fell back asleep under that tree, and I had the sweetest dreams probably that I've ever had in my life. I woke up and I told myself that I was going to use heroin every day for the rest of my life. Eventually, I got up to leave the park. Well, I don't remember what I did after that. But when I left the park that day, I left the best part of myself there. And the part that I walked out with, walked out cursed.
So, I'll never forget the first night that I saw the Aurora Borealis. It's about 3 a.m. in the morning, and we're shivering in a deserted campground in the middle of a remote provincial park in Mackenzie, B.C., way up there, way up in Mackenzie, B.C., and you don't know, any of you, what Mackenzie, B.C. means because it doesn't exist to you. That's how far in the middle of nowhere Mackenzie, B.C. is. It's minus 29 Celsius. For you non-Canadians, that's minus 20.2 Fahrenheit. Bob and Scott are watching David and I as we struggle to zip our drummer Keith into my parka with me in it in an attempt to keep him from freezing to death as he's a skinny little bastard and he's stark naked. All right, let me back this up a little bit. For many years, I was in a traveling band that toured Canada. And because we weren't famous, our agent would use the dartboard method when he was scheduling our tours. Yeah, they're going to Mackenzie this week. It was awesome. Florida, Mackenzie. Somewhere in Utah. Yeah, you get it. So that's how we ended up in Mackenzie at the end of September to play music for a hotel/tavern that was holding some kind of lumberjack festival, basically 300 guys in flannel shirts getting shit-faced in a bar. We had arrived just in time to set up our gear and play, so that's what we did. It was only after our final set that the bar manager informed us that the hotel was completely booked, so he was putting us up at a nearby campsite about 15 miles away. Yeah. Yeah. In the middle of a mountain pass, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a cold snap. He had, thankfully, arranged tents and sleeping bags for us, which I thought was really nice. Needless to say, we weren't pleased. There's lots of grumbling, mostly from Kevin, who was a notorious whiner. Kevin was our drummer. And I have to take a moment to describe this picture. So there's Buffalo Bob, our sound man, who is a very tall African-American man, very rare in those parts at that time of the century, dressed in jeans, boots, leather jacket, and his usual huge cowboy hat. Scott, our bass player, is even taller at 6'5", and he's stockier than Bob, and he's got a full head of long, curly, pitch black hair and a black beard. He's dressed completely in black, except for his red biker's bandana. He looked like a gothic pirate. David is 6 foot and 140 pounds. He's wearing jeans that accentuate his completely bow-legged legs. And he, too, is wearing cowboy boots, but his long brown dreadlocks are not covered by a hat. Kevin, our drummer, weighs maybe 90 pounds. He has long, straight hair down to his ass and this pretty little baby face, and he's dressed in his usual after-gig wear of baggy sweatpants and a faded sweatshirt and sneakers. And he's still got his gig mascara on and a little bit of lipstick. His jacket is ridiculously large. He looks like a cross between a new wave street urchin and Kenny from South Park. I am long-legged and long blonde hair and a very young 21, 2-ish years old female in lumberjack country. Enough said. Okay, so we struggle with the tents. But it was freaking freezing outside, and we were tired, and the tents were missing some rods, of course, so we decided we'd sleep in the van. It would be majorly uncomfortable, but at least we had the sleeping bags and our mass body heat. Minus 29 below zero. We went about the business of visiting the single frozen porta potty and taking turns using the van as a dressing room to change into warmer clothes, and then on the horizon, that's when it happened, Aurora Borealis appeared. Oh my God. For anyone who has never witnessed Aurora Borealis in their lifetime, you have not lived yet and you need to put it on your bucket list. Because there on the horizon, this massive flame of every kind of color, pink and blue and green and waving and these spirits just dancing and about. It was fantastic. It looked like it was stretching to the moon. It was so brilliant. We just sat there like we were drugged and watched it as the entire horizon just waved with these colors. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. Bob tries to take a picture of Aurora Borealis. He's got a little flash on this little tiny camera. And he points it at the sky. It's pitch black. There's no lights. And the flash goes off. And it is a fireball of phosphorescent. I've never seen it. It's like Tinkerbell. It's just going like this and just spreading Tinkerbell energy through the entire campground. It's just Tinkerbell flying, going everywhere. And we're laughing hysterically. Oh my God, Bob's still trying to take pictures of it. It's just nothing but fucking lights, like fucking Tinkerbell is fucking exploding. And we're fucking up. The second most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. Still! Then, out of nowhere, strike me dead, whoever runs this entire planetary system, if I'm lying, this wind comes out of nowhere. It's like a Santa Ana. We're in the middle of Mackenzie, BC. It's minus 29. And it's a warm wind. And the temperature jumps up from minus 29 to like 60, 70 degrees. Out of nowhere. I'm not lying. I'm not. We weren't drunk. We were like, oh, okay. So we run around like idiots. And Bob is the first one to take off his shirt. So the rest of us follow suit, me included, and we're running around with our arms outstretched in this campground in the 70-degree weather that used to be minus 29 and leaping and frolicking and... And Bob's still trying to take pictures of this stupid fucking camera of pitch blackness. And, you know, all of us are shirtless. And then we suddenly see Kevin sprint past us, butt naked and laughing hysterically. There's not a stitch of clothing on him. He looks like a bald chicken streaking. So we're running around like this for a good 5 minutes or so. And just as quick as it came, the warm wind disappears. And the temperature drops in a freaking instant. And everyone is scrambling for their shirts and jackets. And skinny, naked Kevin races for the van and yanks on the door handle. And it's locked. So he's performing naked jumping jacks and he's hitting himself. And you can no longer see his package because it's probably shrunk into his stomach from the bitter cold. And he's completely panicked. And we realize it's not going to take long before the 90-pound motherfucker freezes to death. So I volunteer to zip him into my jacket because no one else wants to cuddle with scrawny naked dude. So little long-haired Kevin is pressed against the warmth of my body as Bob the Black Cowboy and Scott the Pirate watch David the Rastafarian, who is now on his knees in front of me, trying to work the zipper up and over Kevin's skinny, white, naked ass. And that's exactly when the park ranger flashes his lights on us. And that's why I'll never forget the night I first saw Aurora Borealis. Thank you. God bless you, Bob. I miss you.
Thanks, everybody, for being here tonight. Come back next month and share a story with us. I will be lost, I will be lost, I will be lost when I find my way. I will be lost, I will be lost, I will be lost when I find my way. Measure the cost of another day, of another chance to plot and to plan, to be a better man. I will be lost, I will be lost, I will be lost when I find my way. Measure the cost, measure the cost, measure the cost of another day. Prepare the cross that I must bear, get my fair share of the misery and the sweetness of it all. There was a time I was walking blind, I was doing fine, despite my lack of knowing what I left behind. And still I find that things always seem to have a way of growing and moving on without me there. I will be lost, I will be lost, I will be lost when I find my way. Yeah, let me hear it. I will be lost, I will be lost, I will be lost when I find my way. Measure the cost, measure the cost, measure the cost of another day. Yeah. I will be lost, I will be lost, I will be lost when I find my way.
Woo!
Our final guest is an actor, burlesque performer, spoken word artist, and all-out beautiful soul. A restless heartist, she's been traveling a lot lately. In fact, she's traveled from New York to here in St. Louis to enthrall us here at So. This is Erin Renee Roberts.
So before I get into the piece that I have for you that refers to a park, the reference to the park is really subtle, and it's about sex in the park. So shout out to the guy who won the Sex in the Park. So before that, I wanted to give you my list of moments in St. Louis parks. I'm actually born and raised here. My non-stage burlesque name is Erin Renee Roberts. This piece is something that I wrote. It's a 35-minute one-woman show that I performed at the St. Louis Fringe Festival, the Seattle Fringe Festival, and will continue to travel and perform it. So shortly from that, I spun off of this piece and did a burlesque routine as an upright bass, and I played myself and the strings break, and I, you know, reveal myself as a woman instead of a bass. But we can't do that here today, so no one will see my tassels twirl or my G-string. Okay, we won't see that. But before that, yes, my list of St. Louis Park memories, aside from the Sex in the Park reference, is in Deer Creek, there is Rocket Ship Park, or there was Rocket Ship Park, and they tore it down. And I remember going in there and like winning the rocket ship and being the main one to go up and down the slide and having to tell people if they could pass into like my atmosphere and get onto this rocket ship. But this is me as a little kid, so I wasn't thinking like that. So to that. Okay, so Deer Creek Park, and then I went back and it was a spaceship, it was plastic and I didn't like it, but the swings are the same, so I just stay on that. Also, Tilden Park, it's on the south side. I got lost. I was playing soccer, and me and my sister had to go to a different park, and everybody got into the soccer coach's van and drove off and forgot us because we were going with our parents, but our parents thought that we were in the van, so we were running around Tilden Park screaming and, you know, lost. But it's really small, so you're really not lost. But yeah, that's another memory. Okay, and then I started fainting a lot when I was really little, and Tower Grove Park was the very first place I fainted. I was in a Girl Scout, like, summer camp outing, and I, like, went up to my counselor, and I grabbed her suspenders, and I was like, I can't see. And I was yelling at my sister, who was, like, thinking that I was weird anyway, because she's a year and a half older than me. And then I fainted, and then she realized how serious that was. And my dad's a superhero, so he popped up by the time I woke up. And that's how that ended. Also, I used to have picnics in the park with an ex-boyfriend of mine, which is where this... I'll talk about him later. Okay. And then also in Forest Park, there's a lot of things that I do in Forest Park. I go to the to Twilight Tuesdays. I've been at the zoo since birth. I've been to the boathouse, and I've been paddle boating. I took my dog on the boat, and, you know, all these different beautiful things that you do in Forest Park. Forest Park, I feel like I'm Pocahontas, right? Like, I feel like I know every rock, every creature, every tree, right? And there's this particular rock in Forest Park that I will talk about later. But yes, so most of my memories are set in Forest Park. So again, this is an excerpt from my one-woman show. And I am a goddess. My name is Eros. I'm the goddess of intimate love and desire. I go through my experiences with my muse. I have an art muse, a dance muse, and a music muse. My first muse is my music muse, hence the suit. Flashing back, I remember your playing. I see your hands graze the neck of your Lady K. I am your audience. The others in the bistro, their laughter and chatter fall silent. Through the melody, the hot air blown through cool brass instruments. Through the rhythm, maintained by percussive drums and keys. Deep, vibratory, and sensually low, your bass. Your graceful hands, sorry, I'll pick up on that. Your graceful jazz hands meddle with my heart. I can't help but to picture myself in her place as your talented fingers caress her neck. Glissando. I feel that. The vibrations resonate just below the belt and zap out the tips of my toes. Pluck. The tugging and releasing of her strings manipulate my heartbeat. Slap. Place your hands to her body, giving her moans a rest. Ease the tension of her strings till the resounding stings are alleviated. Walk. Boom, 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 boom. Your fingers up and down her neck. Your textured fingers from the coarse calluses that you've earned. Up and down along her strings at a steady rhythm, begging me to dance. Glide your hands along her body. The contours of her shape, her stance, and your arms around her build up my hate for her, my jealousy. Rest your hands now, but keep up the sway, because now I submit to the urge to groove with you. The postmortem of that relationship is the next piece. Can I move this? As I stand in a hot, steamy shower, I can just make out the naked back of you. The water droplets stream down your spine like tributaries down the great Mississippi, down your back, down your crack, and down the drain. When I reach out my hand to feel the moisture of your back, akin to the moisture between my legs, I realize that I'm alone in the shower. Back in bed now, because that shower didn't do shit. I think of ways to tease you. I remember you teasing me. You tie my wrists and arm to the bedpost. You trace the contours of my body, your fingers ritualistically praising the curvature of my body. You are as skilled as the most tantric of Reiki masters, starting at the crook of my neck. You remember the spot. You have tied my ankles and wrists to the bedpost so that I won't try to stop you. I plot of ways to return the sensual tease. You lean forward for a kiss. Still tied, I lean forward. Still forward, still further forward. I'm able to sit all the way up without ever meeting your lips, those smooth, moist lips of yours. At some point, you must have cut the ropes for my hands and my wrists and my ankles and hid somewhere, because now that my eyes are open, I can't find you. Now that my eyes are open, I don't see you here beside me. I touch that spot in the crook of my neck where you traced. I feel a bruisey hickey, so I look in the mirror for confirmation. And there's nothing there. Nothing. I lie in bed alone again. I take my pillow between my legs and I play our song, Stand By Me. Do, 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 do. I play it on repeat. Do, 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 do. And I dream of those moments. The first time, That first time I covered my eyes, there was no cherry then. The time in the car, when the sweat and breath we took fogged up the windows and cloaked us in. That time in the park, on the rock, our rock, where a bicyclist rode by and we fell silent, then burst into laughter. All those times in your bed, when afterwards we'd cuddle, I was almost always the big spoon. I held you the tightest, didn't mind in the slightest. Could never imagine after 5 long years I'd be lying 2,000 miles away with a pillow in your place. The tears tracing the contours of my face. It's funny. It's been 2 years since our breakup, and I still can't get out of the cave your hair made around our heads when you laid on top of me. I squeeze my pillow tight now. Our song still on repeat, the 6th time through. My eyes open wide, I realize that this pillow isn't you. This vibrating plastic rubber tube isn't you. My fingers aren't your fingers, my moans aren't your moans, and I still hold you the tightest. I still feel your presence in the shower. I feel a tingle in the crook of my neck. So, my time with you is something that haunts me like a ghost. I wake up. We're 12 years old again, and those 5 years haven't even happened yet. But I'll let them play out again, like they did again, and become a memory, a dark memory of a distant past again. You see, I'm not still in love with you. I just haven't loved someone else since. Thank you.
Well, there you go. Another evening of inspiring music and stories recorded live from the Tavern of Fine Arts in the beautiful Forest Park District of St. Louis. We'd like to give a huge thanks to our guests this month, Christopher Harrison, Nick Drago, the lovely Erin Renee Roberts, and our recurring musical feature, Matt McGahey. So, Stories of Life is produced by Outrageous Productions, live recording and post-production by Morse Media. Our SO events are made possible by donations from you, our listeners, and we're extremely appreciative of your support to help keep our podcast going strong. Do you have a story you'd like to share on our podcast? Simply submit a brief synopsis to so.storiesoflife@gmail.com. I'm Tia King, and I thank you for listening.